Our next case is number 033599, Gary L. Branham against Paul H. O'Neill. Should have been changed. Mr. Griffin.
May it please the court. The bench, the bar, and the public have a right to rely on the precedent of the Seventh Circuit. An affirmance of the district court's judgment in this case cannot coexist with this court's opinion in Lawson versus CSX Transportation Company. Like Lawson, Gary Branham has insulin-dependent type 1 diabetes. The record is full of references to the limitation that the disease has on Gary Branham. He takes 4 to 6 shots a day, 120 to 150 a month. He finger sticks his fingers for blood tests the same amount each month. He has to...
Yeah. Mr. Griffin.
Yes, ma'am.
Under your argument, would any person with type 1 diabetes who required daily insulin shots have a disability under the ADA, because they would be engaging in the same daily balance of insulin, eating, exercise, and would have the very same potential that goes along with noncompliance?
No, Your Honor. I think it has to be judged in its individualized state. I think that's what has to happen. Type 1, like type 2s, have a variation of symptoms, a variation of treatment regimens. Some are on oral medications, some are not. Some take 1 shot a day, some take 4 shots a day. There's a myriad of different ways and limitations that people with type 1 diabetes have. Mr. Branham's, though, is a very intensive, as described by the government staff. It's burdensome, it's intensive, it's repetitive, it's 24 hours a day, it's every minute of every day, balancing food intake, insulin intake, and exercise.
Well, is there evidence in the record as to the amount of time it takes daily to calculate the appropriate amount of insulin and administer it?
There's lots of conflicting evidence in the record, Your Honor. The government says sometimes it takes too long for his insulin to take effect. It can take effect not in minutes, but in too long a period of time that he cannot regulate his blood sugar well enough to be functioning. And so there is also evidence that each time he has to give himself a shot, he has to draw up his insulin, he has to do the blood stick. But I don't think there's evidence of each time it takes. I think it takes at least 30 seconds to a couple of minutes to do one particular finger stick. But one has to wait, and the evidence is in the record that some insulins last longer than others, some insulins hit faster than others. But what we've got to remember, though, Your Honor, is that we don't take just each grain of sand in the sandbox here. We have to look at all the evidence, the finger sticks, the shots, the sweats and the shakes every 3 weeks, the fact that he can't exercise like the rest of us when he wants to. He has to check his blood sugar, he has to make sure his insulin is appropriate, and he has to make sure of all of that before he either eats, before he exercises, or before he administers any.
What does the record show about what your client has to do varying his diet on a day-to-day basis, either with respect to the kinds of food he eats or when he eats?
The government doctor says he's impaired in eating. He was asked a specific question in the record. Is he impaired when compared to the rest of us and how we eat? He says yes. He's got to be careful of the carbohydrates he takes, because he's got to carefully balance that with insulin. If he underestimates the amount of carbs and overinjects insulin, he has the risk of hypoglycemia, which ultimately can result in passing out. If he doesn't take enough insulin over a period of days, his blood sugar can be so high that he gets what we call DKA. And so those are the immediate consequences of his failure to appropriately define his diet. He says, I have to carefully balance, and the government agrees. Their doctor says it's a careful, burdensome balance of diet. He cannot, presumably we can, eat whatever he wants, because a normal person's pancreas will compensate for it. He can't do that. Before he can have an extra piece of pie on Thanksgiving, he has to consider the amount of insulin required to cover it, and he can't have the pie at all if he doesn't have the insulin. If he does have the insulin, he has to carefully do his blood stick check and balance those three parts of the triangle before he can eat it. And those things are all in the record. Now, the government's view is that even with all that, he's still so limited that he's at constant risk for suddenly blacking out. Now, the district court felt that this was a double bind, that the government were trying to show he was so limited to make their direct threat affirmative defense, and then on the other hand, arguing that he's not disabled at all, that he does so well in life. He can dress himself, he can get up in the morning. But the district court, in getting itself out of what it perceived to be the double bind, weighed conflicting evidence. There's plenty of evidence in this record from the government that they felt that he was sudden risk for blackout, that he was unable to think critically, that he had difficulty responding when summoned. And they want to argue, and they argued in the court below, but we just viewed him in the prism of a special agent at the IRS. But the way we respond to that is if an employer thinks the person is blind so that they can't be a Swiss watchmaker, that employer has just regarded them as disabled in the life activity of seeing, not making Swiss watches. Under the government's perception, Mr. Branham was basically an invalid, impaired and limited in taking care of himself because they felt he was out of control, had too many high blood sugars, too many low blood sugars, that he was such a risk that he was at constant risk for blackout. And so the double bind, the district court was obligated to accept the facts of Mr. Branham, take the facts that are favorable to him in the government's record, which is quite considerable. You'll see in our brief the citations to the, it's an overwhelming record of the government's view that this man was substantially limited. Now, the district court, when it reasoned with this court's view of Lawson, felt that, or tried to distinguish it by saying, well, but Lawson, he had a few other things, and he had a little complications on the other side of that. But when you go to this court's holding that is in the record, when we go actually to the holding on page 924, which is quoted word for word, none of these distinctions matter. They're not material. And that's why we say we have a right to rely on the precise holding of this court in Lawson because we got more than what's in that holding.
Are you arguing that as a matter of law, he is limited in the function of eating, or are you asking us to send that to a trier of fact?
Send that to the trier of fact, because that was the precise holding of this court in Lawson that the court is quoting the evidence. It says this evidence is sufficient to go to the jury. That's what this court held in Lawson. And in the appropriate standard of review is that, and we think the district court jumbled it up trying to mix up the parties' motions on direct threat and disability. On each motion, the non-movement was entitled to the deference. The evidence was supposed to be collected, and then the movement's evidence was to be disregarded except to the extent that the jury was legally obligated to believe it. This court made that standard of review of Reeves very clear last month in the Tart case. And so our view is that when the district court, in order to extricate it from what it perceived to be this double bind, started weighing evidence, ignoring Lawson, and ignoring the standard of review in Reeves, committed error. And that's why our view is this case has to be sent back to the trier of fact so that the issues of direct threat, disability...
Now, the government has argued that the district court can be affirmed here on the basis that your client was not qualified for the job, and you haven't responded to that. Isn't that good enough to decide the case?
No, Your Honor. The qualification standard under the statute, qualification talks about education experience.
Well, you haven't responded to that argument, have you?
Not today, but in our reply brief we do. Their changing horses is on an issue upon which they have the burden of proof. That's direct threat. They have, at this stage of the proceeding, argued in the appellee's brief that, yeah, well, even if he's disabled, he can't do the job because of a direct threat. We have pointed out in our reply brief a complete swearing match between the government's doctors and the doctors that we had that say that he's not a direct threat, he's not a risk. We move for summary judgment, Your Honor, in the court below because they never assess the probability of the direct threat. The Supreme Court in Bragdon says few, if any, activities in life are risk-free. That's why we show that the party bearing the burden of proof on direct threat must show a substantial likelihood of the threat. We have to measure the probability of its occurrence versus the magnitude of the harm, and we think we have briefed that. We felt we were entitled to summary judgment on that issue in the case below because the government had not sustained its burden. However, at this point, we're asking the case to be sent back to the district court to be reviewed by the trier of fact.
Was the issue of direct threat squarely before the district court?
By the plaintiff it was, Your Honor. We moved for direct threat on their affirmative defense. The district court didn't reach it. The government responded by saying, well, we think he's a direct threat as a matter of law. Even the plaintiff says he's not a direct threat as a matter of law. We don't believe they ever got to the lip of the cup to be able to make the direct threat argument because they never confronted the probability of the threat. It was always a generalized, abstract, speculative threat not applied to this particular person.
I have the point. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll hear now from Mr. Hunter.
May it please the court, my name is Jeffrey Hunter. I'm an assistant U.S. attorney representing the defendant in this case. And actually, Your Honors, based upon several of the questions that were asked, there is evidence in this case concerning what Mr. Branham could do or could not do on a daily basis and what he had to do about his eating on a daily basis. And that evidence is both in Mr. Branham's complaint and a declaration that he filed with the defendant in connection with the reconsideration of his condition. And that evidence is that Mr. Branham has repeatedly said that he's able to spend long, unanticipated hours on the job, is able to travel, and is able to perform a job that forces him to skip meals occasionally. That's been his complaint.
Is it your position that regardless of the amount of time and effort it takes for him to keep his blood levels stable, that he's not substantially limited in eating as long as he can keep it stable with whatever that effort is?
Yes, Your Honor. In this case, based upon the facts that Mr. Branham has presented, he is not substantially limited in either the major life activity of eating or caring for himself, which are the two factors that Branham has advanced to this court as alleged error.
But if all of his eating has to be planned.
Well, that's not what...
Both in timing and in type of food and coordinated with his insulin shot, can we say he's not substantially limited in eating?
Well, Your Honor, actually the evidence is that it doesn't have to be so rigorously planned. The evidence from Mr. Branham's declaration that we referred to below and have referred to in the briefing is that Mr. Branham has said there's many times when he skipped lunch and many occasions when I worked late unexpectedly, requiring my dinner to be delayed. And there, Mr. Branham also said that there were many instances in the course of the past several years that have required me to completely miss or significantly delay meals. To the extent we're looking at the facts as to Mr. Branham, the facts here are that Mr. Branham has significant flexibility in what his eating patterns.
But didn't he have consequences to that kind of, non-planning, shall we say?
Well, the evidence is, Your Honor, Mr. Branham says that once every 2 or 3 weeks he gets the shakes and the sweats as a result of that.
Right.
That is the only thing that he says that he gets. Given his factual situation, we would submit that is not a substantial limitation.
Well, of course, up to now he hasn't sort of, dropped dead or whatever, right. But that's a pretty... I mean, having seizures, so to speak, every few weeks is pretty dramatic, isn't it?
Well, Mr. Branham asserts that he's not affected in his ability to operate or conduct business in connection with those, that they're relatively minor. I would submit that under the facts of this case, they're not a significant, substantial limitation on his ability to eat or care for himself. The facts here are not like the facts in Lawson or in the Nile Rock case, In both of those cases, even with the regime of insulin treatment, there were significant physical impairments that resulted. There were complications. There were times when the individuals were not able to function. There were a whole host of problems that just are not present here for Mr. Branham. In fact, we would submit that, you know, in many ways, this is has a lot of analogies to the facts in the Sutton case. In the Sutton case, the people wanted to be pilots. They had to wear glasses. And the Supreme Court found that in that case, those individuals were not disabled. Mr. Branham here is able to do many things that a normal person can do, and he has repeatedly said that he's able to skip lunches, unexpectedly work late, delaying meals. He's able to not to follow the strict kind of regime that is described in both Lawson and Narut, and he's able to do much more than those without the significant problems that were present in those cases.
Did the government know he was a diabetic when he was hired?
To the current position that he's in?
Yeah.
There's no evidence in the record regarding that. What happened here is he was doing a job fine. He attempted to get a promotion to a gun-carrying law enforcement position. And he was tentatively accepted for that, as every other individual was tentatively accepted, subject to the medical review. And during the course of the medical review, the diabetes and problem was discovered. And in fact, the evidence that was considered was evidence largely that he submitted. He submitted his insulin log that showed variations in his blood sugar that gave the reviewing doctor concern. He submitted his A1C test that showed problems over the long term with his control of his diabetes. And so he was able to perform the job he is in. And all the defendant is saying is he's not able to perform this particular new job that he wants to do.
Well, there was a preliminary decision made that he was qualified subject to this physical examination.
Yeah, and part of the qualification for the job are being able to meet the physical qualifications for the job. Every individual who's selected for the job.
But when they made that decision, did they know he was a diabetic?
There's no evidence in the record regarding that. So we would submit that the facts in this case are such that, as one of the questions indicated, if Mr. Branham is considered to be disabled, is there any insulin-dependent diabetic who would not be considered to be disabled as a matter of law? And we think that kind of analysis and that kind of logic is directly contrary to the individualized assessment required under Sutton and Toyota and the decisions of this court.
Now, in your brief, you touched on a possible limitation as to working. Is that an issue that we ought to consider here?
Well, the working actually was raised by the plaintiff in his complaint in connection with his regarded as claim. And the second point on that really is that by analogy, the Toyota case discussed the fact that you were not significantly limited if substantially limited if there was only one job that you could not do because of the condition. I think the argument here is there's only one job Mr. Branham can't do. And so if he's not substantially limited in connection with the working, it's hard to see by the same logic how he would be substantially limited in the major life activity of eating or caring for himself, where all that has been said is you can't do this specific job because of these concerns. One of the questions was asked about whether or not Mr. Branham was qualified for the job and whether that had been discussed below. That issue was presented to the court below in the defendant's motion. We would submit that the Branham is not qualified for the job below because he doesn't meet the physical requirements of not being able to perform the
job.
Was
this you joined completely on that in the district court?
Yes, Your Honor.
It's not contested here, though, I gather, is it?
Well, I had the same concern and question about the Branham's brief as was raised previously about whether that issue was addressed. It was not clear to me that it was. The evidence is that given the special concerns of this job Mr. Branham wants to get is a gun-carrying law enforcement job. The evidence is that persons with that job may be put in situations where they're required to have instantaneous judgment in serious, serious situations. And because of the situation Mr. Branham is in, there were significant questions about whether he could perform that on an ongoing basis. Mr. Branham's counsel has stressed that once every 2 or 3 weeks he's in a situation where he gets the tremors and the sweat. That is the concern that the evidence that Mr. Branham submitted in connection with his employment raised for the defendant. So I see that my time is up. I thank the court, and unless there are any questions, I'll conclude.
Thank you, Mr. Hunter.
Thank you.
Your time had expired, sir, therefore the case will be taken under advisement.